Thanks for listening to us on the Jefferson Exchange today. We're always glad for your time and attention. And if you'd like to take part in our conversations on the exchange, you're more than welcome. Phone numbers 800-838-3760 anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. One of the more notable chapters in American history is a damp one, damp as in the ocean. When you stop to think about the American Revolution and the War of 1812, it's nearly inconceivable that a ragtag bunch of former colonies managed to beat the strongest sea power the world had known until that time. And one of the more notable commanders and his exploits are laid out in the book The Shining Sea, David Porter and the Epic Voyage of the USS Essex during the War of 1812. George C. Dawn is the historian who wrote the book. He got his Ph.D. in American History and Government from Harvard and won the Samuel Eliot Morrison Award 5 years ago for naval literature for his earlier book, If by Sea. George Dawn, our guest on the exchange today. George, welcome.
It's wonderful to be with you. All the way from Portland, Maine.
That's right, the other Portland, right. We're not talking to the Portland closer to us.
Right.
You know, I have to admit, from early on in life, I was a fan of John Paul Jones, and I'd certainly heard of both Perrys in the War of 1812. Hadn't heard of David Porter Jr. up to this point. He's a bit of a revelation to most people, it seems. Why do you suppose that is?
Well, because although he achieved great things, he had great flaws, and his great battle during the War of 1812 was in Valparaiso Harbor in Chile, and he lost it. And he lost it because of his own shortcomings. And so he hasn't been made the hero that other people like Decatur and so on and Perry have. Interestingly enough, after his defeat in Chile, he made his way back to the United States because of the good graces of the British commander who defeated him. And he didn't know quite how he was going to be received here when he got to New York. But to his surprise, he was greeted as a hero everywhere by people, by newspapers, and by the president of the United States, Madison, who needed heroes. Things were not going so well in the summer of 1814 when Porter appeared back in New York. And so Madison decided he would forget about his shortcomings and concentrate on how well his ship was defended against a superior British force in Valparaiso Harbor. Madison, in the summer of 1814, thought that he was going to have to fight Britain for a very long time, and things did not look good. And he remembered back to the Revolution when there were times when Washington was experiencing the same kind of situation where things looked very bleak. And Washington's view was that he was never going to give up. He was going to fight on no matter what. And Madison took his cue from his mentor, Washington, and decided that he was going to do the same thing. And Porter's defense of his ship in Valparaiso Harbor and the bravery of his men struck a responsive chord in Madison's heart because of how they fought. And he just simply overlooked the fact that they had lost. It was the fact that they had fought on despite the odds.
So he was hailed as something of a conquering hero, even though he was more like a conquered hero.
Exactly. And Madison also overlooked the fact and didn't pay attention to and maybe didn't even know that Porter should never have been there in the first place. Porter sought out this battle. The British were after him because he was so successful in the Pacific, but in a really weird situation, he was actually going after them. He wanted to fight it out and be acclaimed as a great hero, and it all went to his head, and so he got himself involved with a much superior British fleet in Valparaiso. And he could have easily have avoided, not been there at all, simply run away. But he didn't, and he lost.
So David Porter Jr., it's not just that he is a bit of a mystery. I mean, the War of 1812 is still such a mystery. I mean, no real bicentennial observances that I could make out. But why do you suppose that is?
It's really odd, because the War of 1812 was very important in American history. And why it has not received the recognition that it ought to have is a puzzle. One of the things that I've found, I've written two books on the war, is that it is celebrated quite extensively in all the areas that it touched east of the Mississippi, so that when you look at where the war touched, it actually touched nearly every place east of the Mississippi, and those communities are celebrating. I've been invited to speak in many places. The state of Maryland has the War of 1812 on its number plate, so individual communities remember the war, but the country as a whole doesn't, and certainly in our history books, it's practically unknown. Some of the history books don't devote any time at all to it, but it was important because of a number of factors. One, it changed the whole relationship between England and the United States. So the two great English-speaking countries, after the War of 1812, drew closer. They never fought again. And there was a long history in the 19th century between these two countries when they might have, because of differences, gone to war, but they didn't. And by the end of the century, they had drawn much closer because of the reunification of Germany in Europe around 1870.
Okay, let's pause there, and we'll take a break. George Don, our guest, The Shining Sea, the book. We'll be back. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the historian George C. Don. He wrote the book The Shining Sea, David Porter and the Epic Voyage of the USS Essex During the War of 1812. That subtitle should pretty well let you know what the book is about. You can join us here on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in our listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, and by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So, George, let's finish up the thoughts about the importance of the War of 1812. Britain, at this point, at the end of this war, gave up the idea of ever subjugating the United States to British power again, it sounds like.
Exactly. They changed their whole attitude towards the United States, their whole policy, and because of that, the two countries were at peace for throughout the 19th century, when they could have been at war over a whole lot of things. Just think of things like the whole Canadian boundary, 3,000 miles. They could have been fighting about that for the next 100 years. But then the great alliance of these two countries in World War in the 20th century, and all they did for the world, and really this great relationship is the basis of world peace today. I think all of that began as a consequence of the War of 1812, so it was of great importance in the history of our country. The whole movement west of the United States, the whole expansion west was made possible by a new relationship with the British. Also during this war, the U.S. Constitution, our whole political system, was strengthened because the president did not become a dictator in order to fight the war. Everybody in Europe thought he would have to be, and Madison refused to be, and he strictly adhered to the limits placed on the presidency by the Constitution, and it gave the people at the end of it enormous confidence that their government could be equal to any challenge. That was of great importance in our history. Another thing was that the franchise was expanded. The whole democratic impulse of the country, that is the foundation of our republic, was strengthened during that time as well. And lastly, the American people finally decided that they needed a respectable army and navy in order to defend their constitution. Up till that time, we had been debating whether or not a respectable army and navy might be a threat to our constitution, might result in some kind of a dictatorship. But as a result of this war, we decided we would build, we would maintain a respectable force, and it wouldn't, and it would be a protection for our constitution, not a threat to it. And that was a huge change in our and important in our history.
George Don, I have to ask a personal question before we go any further. You're an Air Force veteran yourself. How did a guy who was in the Air Force get so interested in writing books about the Navy?
Well, I wanted to write years ago, you're talking about 20 years ago, I wanted to write something about the early American Republic. And after many years of study, it was obvious to me that the naval elements of our early history were left out or shortchanged. And as I spoke to more and more historians around the country, they agreed with me. And so that's how I got into writing about the Navy's part in our early history, not to mention the fact that my whole family was in the Navy. And as I speak to you now, I'm looking at the water. I've been on the water since I was a child. And so the water has always been a great attraction for me.
So your rebellion in life was to go to the Air Force, is that right?
Well, not really. I would have been in the Navy if they had had a Navy ROTC in my college, but they didn't. So I was in the Air Force. I wanted to fly anyway. I thought if I went in the Navy, I'd be a flyer if I qualified, and I did qualify. But there was no Navy ROTC in my school.
You just talked about the reluctance of early American leaders to build the large standing military. So what was the state of the Navy at the outset of the War of 1812, and what did James Madison as president think it would take to win this war?
Well, the American Navy had 20 warships. Six of them were being repaired, so we had 14 serviceable ships, 14. The British had 1,000. 300 of them were in their dockyards being repaired or built. So they had maybe 700 at sea. And when Madison started the war, he didn't think the U.S. Navy was going to amount to anything. He was relying on privateers to be our Navy on the high seas. And in the course of the war, 526 privateers actually set out, and they in time put a lot of pressure on British commerce and were effective. But the surprise to Madison was how effective the U.S. Navy was as well, and he changed his mind completely about the Navy and very early on in the war, and he became a big champion of the Navy, actually. The first big naval battle occurred 800 miles east of Boston between the USS Constitution, Old Ironsides, and the British frigate Guerriere. And the Constitution beat the Guerriere in half an hour. And this was August 19, 1812. Madison was running for re-election. He wasn't very popular. His election really looked in doubt, and particularly since 5 days earlier, the American Army had suffered a big defeat at Detroit, trying to invade Canada from that direction. So, as far as Madison was concerned, this naval victory, which was, even though it was only two ships, was made a big deal of in England and a big deal in this country, and it saved his political hide. He always thought that without the Constitution and the Guerriere, he would not have been reelected. So he changed his mind completely about the Navy, and the American Navy did well, way beyond what anyone thought. Certainly beyond what the British thought. And in 1814. When things were very, very bleak for the United States and England was preparing to invade us, the American Navy played a huge role in defeating the British invasion. The British invasion came from Canada, from the South, from New Orleans, and they had big amphibious raids and small ones all along the east coast of the United States. At one point, they marched into Washington and burned it. That was one of their amphibious raids.
Burned the White House, in fact.
Burned the White House. But the American Navy played a huge role in stopping the invasion from Canada. They played a very big role in New Orleans. I outlined that in one of my books, the details of how the Navy was a huge factor. And Andrew Jackson himself was loud in his praise of the very tiny Navy at the Battle of New Orleans that did yeoman service there. And the Navy was of great importance in stopping the British attack on Baltimore. So all of these things together, the battle in Plattsburgh, off of Plattsburgh to stop the invasion from the north, the Battle of New Orleans, and the Battle of Baltimore, all of these things made the British change their mind about invading, made them agree to a peace treaty, and changed their whole policy towards us. So the Navy played a big role in that. It made the British respect us, it was a complete change in how people felt about the Navy in June of 1812 when the war started, and February of 1815 when the war ended.
George C. Dawn, historian, is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is The Shining Sea, David Porter and the Epic Voyage of the USS Essex During the War of 1812. You can join us on the Exchange about this period in history and the exploits of Captain Essex himself, or Captain Porter himself, aboard the Essex. 800-838-3760, anywhere in our listening area. In the Rogue Valley, it's 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Michael in Mendocino. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with George Dawn.
Well, good morning. I remember reading a book by John, is it C. Miller, G. Miller? He was a professor in Santa Barbara, California, who wrote a book. I'm not sure if it came out in his particular book, The Origins of the American Revolution. It was either Mr. Miller or another author, another professor of law, wrote about one of the reasons that the War of 1812 is not talked about in this country to a great extent is because the people like Hamilton and Morris and so on, the people who made up the Federalist era, first 12 years of the constitutional reign, pretty much retired in disgust when Jefferson came in. In fact, according to Miller, I'm pretty sure, but it's been so many years since I've read his book, these ex-Federalists actually aided and abetted the English invasion of 1812. So I wonder if your guest has any further foresight on that. I'll take it off the air.
All right. Thanks for that, Michael. Appreciate it. Interesting stuff there, George.
Well, that's a terrific question, Michael. The political parties in this country before and after the war were deeply divided. There were two parties. One was the Federalists that you mentioned, and the other was the Republican Party, which was the party of Jefferson and of Madison. The Federalists opposed the war from beginning to end, and Madison, to his credit, did nothing at all to try to prevent them from publishing their newspapers or anything of that sort. The basic Federalist argument was that Britain at the moment in June of 1812 was faced with a Napoleonic invasion, and Napoleon right then was about to invade Russia. They thought that would be over very quickly, and then he would turn on them. And if he conquered Britain, we were next. So the Federalists thought we were on the wrong side. We should be allied with Britain against Napoleon, and by declaring war on them, we were, although not formally, we were informally allying ourselves with Napoleon. So they were very angry. And how far were they going to take their anger was the question. Well, they were strongest in New England. There was a lot of talk among them of splitting New England off and becoming either independent or part of Canada. But when actually that particular proposition was put to the people in New England, they wanted no part of it. It turned out that the extreme Federalists, who wanted to split New England off were very, very small in number, that most of the the vast majority of the Federalists were very patriotic, and they might be mad at Madison, but they certainly were not going to dismember the United States. Also, in New England, there was a very large number of Republicans, too. They didn't control the governments. They might have been in a minority, but they were a very big minority. So if the Federalist governors, let's say the Federalist governor of Massachusetts, wanted to break off from the Union, there was going to be no breaking off. He was going to be involved in a civil war. But so there's no doubt that there was division, but the extremists who actually were traitors were comparatively few. And I don't think that accounts for lack of interest in this war. I would think that would stir more interest rather than less. To tell you the truth, I really can't account for why there has been so little interest in this war. It was called at the time and afterwards the Second War of Independence of the United States, and I think it actually was. So you would think that students who were studying the Revolution, which of course is widely studied, would also be interested in the Second War of Independence, but that has not been the case, and I have not been able to account for it. Professor Miller, who you mentioned, was a great scholar and a great writer, and greatly admired certainly by people like me, who were fledglings when he was in his prime. But he never figured the thing out either. It was a question mark in his mind as well. Good question.
Yeah, thanks for that, Michael. Let's go to Bill and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with George C. Dawn. His book is The Shining Sea.
Hi, thanks a lot for taking my call. I have a question regarding a Navy skirmish or whatever you want to call it in Maine, I believe, or Canada, in that area. I'd like to know the waterway where the date. I read this on a historical marker put out by the DAR, and I just wanted to really find out if it's true, but it was the worst surrender of U.S. Navy craft to date. I believe they were surrendered 40 Navy vessels. They might have been just big rowboats. And the Navy fleet, if you want to call it a fleet, was being chased by a British fleet.
Uh-huh. And this is on the Great Lakes?
2-3-1. And I wonder what waterway it was. And it also said that one of the co-captains in charge of the 40 American ships, or big rowboats, was Paul Revere and one other person. And after that, Paul Revere was given a dishonorable discharge from the Navy. And I just wonder if you could verify that.
And where was this supposed to have taken place?
It took place up in Canada or Maine, where the border areas, where they were the British, they were fighting the British.
All right. Well, we'll work from there. Thanks for the question, Bill. Appreciate it.
Well, it's an interesting question, Bill. What you're saying about Paul Revere did not happen, but the incident that you're talking about occurred in 1779 in Penobscot Bay in Maine, and it was a defeat for an American fleet. Most of that fleet was composed of ships from the Massachusetts Navy, state Navy, and Paul Revere was involved in it, but he performed very well. He was one of the few heroes coming out of that episode. The GOAT, the American leader, was named Saltonstall, and he was duly censored for that, but Paul Revere came out quite well. So it's the Battle of Penobscot Bay in 1779 that you are referring to. It has nothing to do with the War of 1812, but it was a famous episode, and it's still studied here in Maine and in Boston, although it certainly was one of the low points in our history.
Was the number close to correct, though, about 40 naval craft?
It was less than that, but it was around 25, something like that, but a substantial number.
All right, so that was
and they were very small, as he mentioned, very small boats. They really weren't. You couldn't say they were warships. They were something like rogue galleys with maybe a gun or something on them.
All right, and that was in Penobscot Bay in Maine.
Off of Maine, yeah.
All right. Our guest is George C. Dawn.
His book question.
Yeah, thanks for that, Bill. The book is The Shining Sea, David Porter and the Epic Voyage of the USS Essex during the War of 1812. We'll talk a bit more about David Porter than we have thus far when we come back and talk more with George C. Dawn. You can join us. Again, the number is 800-838-3760, anywhere in the region. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Back with George C. Dawn, The Shining Sea, and your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today, historian George C. Dawn, on the line from Portland, Maine. His latest book is called The Shining Sea, David Porter and the Epic Voyage of the USS Essex during the War of 1812. David Porter, not a household name, even today, but a significant figure in early American history because of his naval prowess in the War of 1812, even though he did have a major loss under his belt. You can join us on the Exchange, 800-838-3760 or 541-552-6782. Email jx@jeffnet.org. And this is an email from Scott in Ashland. George, he asks, he puts the nail right on the head here, could your guest briefly explain what Porter was doing in the South Pacific and what strategic significance, if any, naval operations in the Pacific had in the War of 1812?
Great question. Porter had no orders to go into the waters off of the west coast of South America. He went there because the orders he was operating under didn't pan out. He was off the coast of Argentina, and he decided to do something he'd wanted to do all his life, and go into the Pacific. So he did that. The USS Essex was the first American warship to enter that part of the Pacific, and he sort of didn't know what he was going to do until he got there. After he rounded Cape Horn, he went to Valparaiso, which was the major port in that part of the world, and there he decided what he was going to do, which was to attack the British whaling fleet in the area of the Pacific between the west coast of South America and the Galapagos Islands, which are 500 miles off the coast of what is now Ecuador and was then Peru. So this big chunk of territory was the richest whaling grounds in the world for sperm whales, and sperm whale oil was of major importance to Britain, not only for a whole lot of reasons, including British industry. And so disrupting their whaling fleet in that part of the world was a very big deal, and he did it. He did it over a period of 6 months. The British had 24 whalers there. Porter captured 12 of them. The other 12 went into hiding, and so their whole operation in that part of the world was wiped out, and it had a major impact. Or would have had a major impact on their economy. The Admiralty sent warships to hunt him down, and he frustrated them. To begin with, he sailed west from the Galapagos to the Polynesian Islands. The first Polynesian islands you come to are the Marquesas Islands, 2,500 miles from the Galapagos, and he restored his ship there. He restored his men. You can imagine the reception these sailors got from the Polynesian women, all the stories you've read, the movies you've seen, all of that happened to these guys. They fell in love with the place. And Porter had, by this time, captured three full whale boats full of oil, sperm oil. You're talking about a fortune for him and for all of his men. So what did he do? This was an enormous achievement. No one else in the war had achieved what he did. He would have been a great hero, and you would have known his name as well as you know Stephen Decatur or any of the others. But what did he do? Instead of taking his oil in the captured ships and going home, which he should have done, he decides that he's going to go after the British hunters who are hunting him so that he can achieve a naval victory over a British warship in addition to all the stuff he's already done. This is what he was doing. And the first place he headed after the Marquesas Islands, the first place he headed for was back to Valparaiso because he figured the British were going to look for him there. And they did. And they found him. And a great battle ensued, and Porter fought as well as anyone could fight under these circumstances when he was outnumbered and outgunned. And he gave a very good account of himself. So did his men. It was a great heroic battle, and there were points at which he might have even won it. But in the end, he didn't because he was up against some really good British captains. The lead captain was a guy named Hillier, who was a protege of Admiral Nelson, the famous Lord Nelson. Hillier was as good as Porter was, and so you had two stars fighting it out, and since Hillier had the superior force, he won. So what was Porter doing in that part of the world? He was seeking glory, but he was also seeking to help the war effort, and he certainly helped the war effort. How the fact that he tried to reach beyond and do even more was tragic.
And you were the one who uses the word hubris in this book. I mean, that is, it sounds, yes, like he really did overreach here.
He did.
A couple of things need to be understood, though, about this period in history, because you mentioned the word privateers before, and lay that out for listeners about how that differs from a regular naval captain, and also in the difference between a privateer and a pirate, because they did some similar things, yes?
Yes. Privateers were exactly what the term implies. They were private vessels. They were business ventures. The typical privateer had maybe 12 to 15 businessmen who bought shares in the enterprise. They would hire a captain. The captain often had shares in the enterprise. So it was a business enterprise. But they were going, it was wartime, and they were going in search of enemy merchantmen who they would capture and bring back to their country and sell the contents of the ships and sell the ships and divide the money between the crews, the captain, and the owners of the ship. Now, the Madison administration kept very close control of these ships. In order to be a privateer, you had to be licensed by the American government. You had to have a commission from the American government, and you had to have it on board. And to maintain very strict control, Madison signed every single commission, 526 of them, and his Secretary of State, who happened to be James Monroe, co-signed the commission. So every one of these privateers had this 12-by-12 piece of parchment in his cabin, which authorized him to go hunting enemy merchantmen. If he did not have that commission, he was an outlaw and a pirate, and if the British caught him, they would hang him. If the British caught a privateer who had a commission and could produce it, they were then prisoners of war, and the British Navy caught hundreds of poor American seamen who wound up in their prisons from privateers. The privateers were so numerous setting out from the United States that they had a very big impact on British commerce, and they were an important reason why the British did not want to continue the war after 1814. So they were very powerful. So a privateer is differentiated from a pirate because they were commissioned by the U.S. government. They had to put up a bond, and they were semi-official ships. Whereas pirates were simply outlaws, scum of the earth, the worst kind of murderers and robbers that existed in the world. Even though people confuse the two, they really were completely different.
And so was Porter working as a privateer, or was he actually part of the U.S. Navy?
No, he was part of the U.S. Navy. He was one of the great naval heroes going back to the late 90s, 1790s. He had been a hero during the quasi-war with France between 1798 and 1800. He had been a hero during the war with Tripoli between 1801 and 1805. And he was one of the best fighters and leading lights in the U.S. Navy when the war of 1812 started. And he was given one of their prime ships to be the captain, the USS Essex. And nobody hated privateers more than Porter. He didn't like privateers. He didn't like them because all they fought were merchants. They'd run away from warships, whereas he sought out warships to fight them. Quite a difference.
Absolutely. Some of the details in the book are pretty amazing. When we talk about how Porter rounded Cape Horn, it makes it sound like a stroll, and it was anything but. It was highly successful, ultimately, and faster than a lot of people had made it. But not only the details there, but the details of naval battles, the mechanics of sea battles in the days of sail are really brought to the fore by your accounts here. I mean, a captain really had to take a whole lot of variables into account, didn't he?
He certainly did, The Porter was one of the best sailors in the Navy. Handling these ships, as you can tell from my descriptions of them in the book, and particularly during combat, was hugely difficult. It required a lot of courage. It required a lot of experience. It required a good ship, and it required a very good crew and a brave crew. Keep in mind that the people serving under Porter, as Porter himself, were very patriotic. These were guys who a lot of people thought were fighting for this, that, and the other thing, like money and glory and you know what. But they were also very patriotic. They were fighting for the country, and you needed all of these ingredients to make these machines work in the waters around Cape Horn, as I described. And despite having a great ship, which the USS Essex was, and a great captain, a great crew, they still almost didn't make it.
It was really tough stuff. So Porter, later in his career, did he? You mentioned that he got back to New York, was welcomed as a hero, despite the fact that he lost the Essex at Valparaiso, didn't he?
That's right. The Essex was captured in Valparaiso and taken to England by Hillier, and it was taken into the British Navy and remained in the British Navy until 1837, if you can believe it, despite all the pounding it had taken. It was a remarkable ship. It was then sold for scrap in 1837. If it had remained in this country, we'd still be viewing it. I think it would have been saved.
No doubt. So what, and then did Porter go on to greater things later in his career?
It's really curious because he did an awful lot in the war that nobody recognizes, which is this. When he came home from his defeat in Valparaiso, it was July of 1814. A short time later, the British invaded Washington and burned Washington and so on. And Madison and his Secretary of the Navy tried to get some of the naval heroes, like Porter, involved in the defense of Washington. But the British took it over so quickly that Porter couldn't get there in time. But he and Oliver Hazard Perry and some others tried to stop a portion of the British fleet from getting back down the Potomac, and they did. They stopped them for a period of time, delayed them, and while they did, the city of Baltimore was able to increase, pull together their defenses so that when the British attacked Baltimore, which they did 2 weeks after they had attacked Washington, now this was a huge British invasion, 50 warships. The delay that Porter and Perry and so on were able to achieve made a significant difference. And so he in the Americans being able to win the Battle of Baltimore. So Porter was very important in winning the war because of his contribution to the Battle of Baltimore.
And David Porter is the subject of the book, The Shining Sea. George C. Dawn wrote it. He's been our guest on The Exchange today. George, thank you.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
All right. Tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange, Passenger Rail in Oregon, we'll talk about an open house coming to Eugene tomorrow night. We'll talk to Bill Rausch from the Oregon Shakespeare Festival about directing Bryan Cranston on Broadway, and we'll talk about Conifers with Michael Kaufman. That's all tomorrow on the Exchange. Our producer, Charlotte Duren, our student assistant, Reed Newland. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.